The NASA scientists who recently claimed that the space agency has plans for a spaceship to get to Mars in just 3 days now has stepped it up a notch by claiming that they'll be able to do it in just 30 minutes. Phil Lubin announced on a video blog for NASA that they are working on laser propulsion technology that could get a spacecraft from Earth to Mars in as little as 3 days. Now, the space agency describes a craft which is currently being developed and would rely on technology known to experts as photonic propulsion, which would allow spaceships to explore space at 30% of the speed of light. However, the scientist behind the claim has now said it could take just 30 minutes in the future when the technology has become more advanced. That's amazing. 30 minutes to get to Mars. You're there. That's amazing. Hey, get up to the coasttocoastam.com website. Take a look at some of the pictures that we've got from Greg Orme. Now, if you make your browser a little smaller, you'll be able to see even more detail as we talk about artificial formations on Mars. His book, by the way, is called Why We Must Go to Mars, The King's Valley. Greg's with us next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We're going live down under. We're going to Australia. Greg Orme has been researching possible Martian artifacts since 1994. This is his first media appearance on the subject. The reason for this is he believes that the new evidence is now strong enough to publicize this. He was the discoverer of the crowned face and other possible artifacts in the Kings Valley. Now, he wrote a book on the subject called Why We Must Go to Mars. It is a free download on his website, which is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And first of all, Greg, thank you for that. Our listeners appreciate that.
That's good. Thanks.
Okay, so it's good to have you with us to talk about this. We've got some pictures on our website that you supplied us. And tell us a little bit, first of all, how you got involved in this.
It's hard to say, really. I guess in those days, the internet was just starting to become popular and people would start surfing around and looking at things. And I came to realize that these Mars images were available for free online. And I suppose I was mainly looking at the geological aspect of it, you know, that it was just interesting to look at pictures on another planet, you know.
Were you amazed at what you found?
It was amazing to see what Mars looked like in those days, you know, that the geology of it looked in some way similar to Earth, you know. But in those days, I really didn't find very much as far as possible artifacts or anything like that, you know. Probably the first website I saw on the subject would have been Richard Hoagland, I suppose, in the Enterprise mission.
Tell us about the Kings area, the Kings Valley.
Yes. Well, as I got more and more interested in it, I started going through the Mars orbital camera images, and I think in the end, I probably looked at all of them. I think there's about 100,000 images.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yes, but it's just I just felt it was just such an amazing experience to be looking at another planet like this. You know, I could never have imagined something like this when I was growing up to be able to actually do that. You know.
Well, when we talk about artifacts, Greg, what are we talking about?
Well, it's a difficult subject because it's very easy to look at the sensational side of it as to whether this is a mainstream scientific topic or not. And when I first started to look at it, I just assumed that if something was found on Mars, it would just be something that mainstream science would look at eventually, and eventually we would just go there to see what was going on, you know.
I wish we were there now, but I guess it's going to still be a few more years.
Yes. It was kind of ironic at one point because I got to know Arthur C. Clarke fairly well.
Oh, did you really?
Yes. I found this picture on Mars, one of the first Martian spider images. And it was the one that looked like trees, you know. And I published that on my website at the time. And Arthur C. Clarke contacted me, and he said, "This is incredible." He thought it was like living trees on Mars. And I got to know him quite well. And it was kind of ironic because I found this King's Faith originally in about the year 2000. And he wrote that book about 2001, A Space Odyssey, which was like the next year. And that was all about finding artifacts in the solar system, you know. So it was kind of a weird situation to be in, to be talking to him about that sort of thing, you know.
Those tree pictures on Mars are absolutely amazing. What has science concluded about what they might be? Because I still think they're vegetation.
Well, it's difficult because the south pole of Mars is very cold. It does get close to zero in summer,
yeah,
because the sun doesn't set in summer. It's just like on Earth, you know, you don't have a nightfall for a few months. And so the temperature can get, I think it's about 30 or 40 degrees centigrade below zero at some point. And there's a clear ice sheet over a lot of these formations. And it is possible for salt water to form underneath that clear ice sheet, you know. So there is an outside chance that there could be life that actually evolved on the South Pole like that, you know, that's just living under this clear ice, you know, and when the water becomes melted, you know.
You mean vegetation?
Well, maybe just bacteria or something like that, you know.
And that's
I'd like to have a theory on what they are, but it's not really a biological thing, you know.
What do you think they are?
Well, it's kind of hard to describe on air, but if you can imagine, you know what polygons are? They have these things on the South Pole and other areas on Mars called polygons, and they're just like six-sided pieces of rock. Like it looks similar to like honeycomb from a beehive.
Okay, yeah, I've seen those.
Okay. What it probably is at some point under these polygons, the sun shines down and it starts hitting the CO2, frozen CO2, the dry ice underneath it, and that starts becoming a gas. And that once that becomes a gas, it's trapped under the ice, and then it has to try and escape somewhere. And I think what happens is it tends to follow along the lines of these polygons, if you can imagine the cracks between the polygons. And that actually forms like a tree-like shape because when it hits the next polygon, it goes left and right, and then it hits the next polygon left and right. And so it's like it's blowing dust out from between the polygons, and it creates this geometric shape, you know.
Gosh, I'd rather still believe they're trees, wouldn't you?
Yes, well, so did I, but I don't think there's any real evidence for it, unfortunately. I think Arthur C. Clarke wanted to believe they were trees because he predicted that would happen on Mars. He wrote a book called Sands of Mars in which there was vegetation and that sort of thing.
Well, you know, I've always thought when Schiaparelli and Lowell talked about canals and vegetation along the, you know, when the water seemed to melt, when the ice seemed to melt and form water, that maybe we got vegetation there. But who knows?
Yes.
What do you think happened?
Well, even NASA is saying now, you know, a long time ago that could have happened to me.
What do you think happened to Mars a long time ago? Because it did have an atmosphere at some point.
Well, I have sort of two ways of approaching the whole thing. My first way that I've always approached it is to try to prove that some artifacts do in fact exist. And the only way you can really do that is you use this technique called falsification, in which you have to look at the geological explanations and then show that they don't work. And then the only explanation that's left is that they could be formed artificially. And as a process with that, I've tried to look at an overall model that would somehow explain and be consistent with those artifacts. But that becomes very speculative, and I don't really know how much of that is likely to end up being accurate over time. I can explain basically what I think happened if you want.
Sure, love to hear it.
Yeah, okay. The most likely time that these things were built is a very long time ago, probably about 3 billion years ago or so. I know it seems incredible that they could actually be that old, but NASA themselves have been saying that around that time that Mars was warm and fairly wet, and it probably had a functioning magnetic field. The magnetic poles were still working, and so it's possible that someone visited Mars in that extremely remote past and tried to terraform Mars,
as we've talked about doing now.
Yes, yeah, well, it was basically the same idea, yeah, and they might have well done it in very similar ways to what we want to do it, and but the problem is that Mars is further away from the Sun than we are, and over time, it would have cooled down, and perhaps a colony would have failed. But the premise I say in my book, which is entirely speculative, is that perhaps they seeded life on Earth too, and that basically that's where life on Earth and Mars came from. It came from this visitation very long ago in the past, you know.
I'm convinced. Have you heard of the theories of the late Zachariah Sitchin, Greg?
I've heard of those kind of theories, but as I looked at the evidence of what's on Mars, it doesn't really connect to any of those other kinds of theories. The main reason is that this is too long ago. See,
right.
There could have been no books written about it. There were no people that had even evolved to even see anything like this. It would lucky to have been bacteria on Earth at the time. And so it doesn't really connect to any of those other kind of theories like UFOs or Nibiru or anything like that. I think it was just, if it exists at all, it's a particular thing that just happened, and it's not really connected to a lot of these other theories, you know.
Why do you think, though, why terraform Mars trying to seed it when you had a planet like Earth that had higher possibilities of being able to generate life?
Well, they might have done that as well. You know, it's so long in the past. See, if that did happen, any signs of that would have long ago disappeared.
Sure.
But so you've got to think, if this is 3 billion years ago, Earth may not have even looked habitable at that time. You know, it may have been volcanically active, and perhaps the atmosphere was completely different. And
right. It's a long time ago.
From what I've read at the time, you know, they talk about cyanobacteria in the oceans that possibly have just started to form oxygen, but that was about all that was available, you know.
And when you talk about... Go ahead.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Yeah. And it gets more and more speculative, you know, because I thought that it's good to put some sort of model out there of what might have happened, even if it proves wrong, because it's consistent to what the artifacts actually look like. But the idea is that they may have tried to terraform Mars by making one particular impact with just one meteor, and it transformed the whole planet from being a cold, icy planet to being habitable for a long time. And I go into that in my book, and there's this crater on Mars called the Argia crater. And what I'm saying has happened is, if someone could have sent a single meteor down onto Mars at a very, very shallow angle, so the shock wave travels along the surface. If you can imagine that, you know, instead of going vertically straight down, so the shock wave goes straight down into Mars, it would sort of travel along the surface in a very glancing blow.
Right.
Yeah. And that, at that time, the Argia crater and the shock wave was pointing directly at the south pole of Mars at the time. So all of that energy from that impact would have gone into... sorry, it's a bit hard to talk. I'm getting this bad echo on the phone, and it's...
Okay. Well, we hear you great. You're coming across fine out here.
Okay. Well... So basically, the shockwave would have gone straight at the pole, and it would have created all these volcanoes all over the pole, and they would have melted all of the ice and the frozen air on the pole, and then that would have created this flood and then filled in the Northern Ocean. And with the impact being so strong, there was actually a volcano that formed on the other side of the planet called the Lycium Mons. And that would have formed on the pole as well. So that would have started to melt that pole as well. And so you would have suddenly gone, perhaps even within like decades, from being a cold and planet with no atmosphere to one having a very, very high pressure atmosphere and being quite warm, you know. And it could have been just done with one single meteor strike. And it could have happened by coincidence, but the evidence is quite good that that's in fact what did happen. And so all of a sudden, Mars became this habitable planet for a while until it cooled down again.
And Greg, these artifacts that you've been looking at, let's describe some of them for our listeners, if you would. Go ahead.
Okay, well, it kind of, a very important part of this theory is that the poles started moving after that impact, and they ended up in this place near a crater on Mars called Hellas Crater. And that forms an equator on Mars, and four of the best artifacts, as far as evidence are concerned, are all found on this great circle, like a circle around Mars. And they're so close on this circle that I actually drew this equator on Google Mars, and I can turn the globe and basically just go through all four artifacts, this perfect circle. And one of them is Cydonia, and you probably know the second one is that Nefertiti formation. I think
we've talked about that before.
Yes, and this goes back to the time Tom Van Flanden was alive. And he came up with this idea of this pole being at that position at the time. But somewhat after that, after he died, this King's Valley thing became more popular. And that's also on this equator. And then there's this fourth formation that I just found that I wrote in this peer-reviewed paper about. And it's called the Ferns, and it's possibly a representation of plants. And it's also exactly on this same equator. So the theory is that basically, if all that did happen, then the pole started to move after that impact, and it sort of warmed Mars up, and eventually the pole settled in this one position, and then the artifacts were all formed then. But this still would have been probably a few billion years ago.
Now, were they formed by extraterrestrials who visited Mars, or were they made by inhabitants of Mars?
Well, it's very difficult to say. You know, again, this is just a speculation.
Yeah.
Because it's so long ago, most scientists would think it's very unlikely that life could evolve on Mars that quickly enough for that to happen, especially sentient life. So it's unlikely from that point of view. On the other hand, the artifacts don't really show any sort of high technology. So a possibility that does fit the facts is, if this was an alien terraforming project, then they just seeded Mars, and eventually the life that they seeded grew up and built these things, and then eventually it died away because Mars sort of froze again, you know.
Well, it is kind of a crude form of architecture, isn't it?
It is very crude, yeah. I think another important point with all this is probably because I've thought about it for a long time, but I don't think this is a particularly threatening thing for people to worry about. If all of this did happen like 3 billion years ago or so, whoever did this is long gone. You know, otherwise we would see them everywhere, all over the galaxy with SETI and everything.
Or they may be us, Greg.
Well, that's the idea. You know, the DNA that they seeded on Mars and on Earth probably evolved up to become us, and that's why we look like these faces, you know.
That's very possible. Very possible. Greg, stay with us. We're going to take this quick break, but we're going to come right back and continue talking about this. And then later on tonight, we'll take some phone calls about this. Take a look at the pictures if you can. Get up to our website at coasttocoastam.com. And Lex tells us that the resolution will look better if you make your browser a little smaller. So play with your little computer that way. And go to our website at coasttocoastam.com. Our special guest from Australia, live, Greg Orm. His book is free for a download, Why We Must Go to Mars. Okay, welcome back. Greg Orm with us as we go back to Australia to talk about his work, including Why We Must Go to Mars, The King's Valley. And Greg discovered this back about 15, 16 years ago. Greg, when you say we must go to Mars, you're talking about with human beings, aren't you?
Basically, yes. My impression of the whole thing for a long time is this is one of the greatest things that's happened to humanity in recent memory. You know, I think a lot of people can be a bit scared of this whole subject. They can be xenophobic. They think there might be aliens still there, or somehow it's connected to UFOs and other and things like that. I don't think there's any connection to any of those things, you know. I think whoever did this has been gone for like billions of years, and there's no possible threat to us. But I think it's going to force us to go there to see what it was all about, you know. And if it forces us to go to Mars, it'll more or less force us to create a colony there. It'll force us to send scientists there. And that really gives everything, NASA, everything that they want. It gives the Mars Society and people like that everything they want. All they really want is to colonize Mars, you know. And this is the perfect reason to do it, you know.
Well, we've got to get to these spots just to see if they are artificial or not. I think that's the most important thing. But let me ask you, Greg, if we do get there, are they going to really tell us?
I don't think they're going to tell us very much at all, unfortunately. A lot of it may be an anticlimax to some degree, because I don't think very much is going to be left after billions of years, you know. Even if there was some sort of sign as to where their home planet was, I mean, the Milky Way has changed so much in that time that it may be impossible to even work it out, you know.
There are just a handful of people, yourself included, that are trying to publicize and truly make an effort to get people to understand what could be on this planet. Why isn't mainstream science jumping all over this?
I think it's because it's mixed up with a lot of other fringe topics, you know, like UFOs and things like that, you know, and I can understand that, you know. But my impression, the longer I've looked into this, is this is something completely different to everything else, every other legend about space, even the idea of, like, the von Däniken-like stories, did aliens visit us in the time of ancient? Mm-hmm. I don't think it has anything to do with any of that, you know. I think it's just a thing that happened a long time ago. And whoever was there, they died out a long time ago. And then there's been no further contact, you know, with whoever did that. And so I think when we go there, it'll be a treasure trove for science. You know, there'll be archaeologists who'll want to have a look at it. There'll be anthropologists trying to work out what sort of culture there was. There'll be astrobiologists trying to look for any sort of sign of remnant biology. And that will cause people to move to Mars more and more to look at these things, but in a completely safe way, you know, because I don't think there's any possibility that there's going to be a buried spaceship there or some aliens still living there. And so eventually we'll look at it, we'll try to understand what happened so long ago. But I think it'll help us to colonize the solar system. It's almost like it's waving the keys to the solar system in our face now and say, all you have to do to take these keys is just to look at this sensibly and just say it's not a threat, it's an opportunity, you know.
We're with Greg Orme. He's live in Australia. His book, it's free to download, folks, Why We Must Go to Mars. What mystifies you the most about Mars, Greg?
The whole idea of the Martian artifacts has been very, very mystifying the whole time, you know. I mean, when I started this in about 1994, I had a lot of ideas like everyone else, you know, of what it might have been. And I think probably 90% of the things that I've found and the theories that I've had have just been discarded over time, you know. I mean, and I've tried to make sense of what it all means, and it's been extremely difficult. And the theory that I've come up with, it's not particularly satisfying to me, and it's not particularly, probably not really satisfying to listeners, because it's not very exciting, and it doesn't make a lot of logical sense, you know. People look at something like the Crown Face and they think, well, why would someone build that, you know? But it need not have been a message to us. It may have just been that they were building these things to look at for themselves.
Sure. It's very possible.
Yeah.
And there are other, I'm sure there are other artifacts there that are smaller that we just can't see from above or from Google or anything like that.
Yes. So I think at some stage a critical point will develop when NASA realizes that it's in their best interest to find out what's going on with this, because I think it's going to be one of the biggest sources of funding that NASA has ever experienced, you know. I mean, they could look at the King's Valley even now much, much more clearly than they have done. They could use the maximum resolution with the high-rise orbital camera, for example. But not only that, they can use a technique of, like, taking a picture of the Crown Face 20 times on different orbits, and then just using that data to interpolate a much higher resolution image, and they might get down to like 10 times the resolution of what's available now. So all of these things could be done, but it's just for some reason they just don't seem to want to do it. And I think one day they'll just realize that this is for them, that this is for NASA, and this is for the Mars Society. This is everything they could have wished for, you know. That's my personal opinion on it.
What would disappoint me too is if, let's say, the government of China gets there before we do, and they're pushing their space program, and they're coming along pretty darn fast. I think they're going to set up a base on the moon. They're going to mine for minerals and other resources on the moon. And we had this, you know, we being, you know, Americans, and as far as I'm concerned, Australia was part of that because we're all in the same group, that we let that go. You know, when we stopped going to the moon, we gave that up, didn't we?
Yes, and I think that's part of the psychology of the whole problem. See, I don't think the public really cares about wanting to colonize Mars and the moon because they have too much to spend the money on here. You know, there's disease, and of course the military is always going to want to spend more on weapons, and it's very hard to connect average people with the idea of going to Mars, you know, to create a colony there. And I think they were interested in going to the moon because it was a competition with the Russians and in the Cold War, but after that there's never been a pressing reason for it anymore.
No, we kind of gave up on it. Now we went to robotics, and we have great robotics, but there's nothing like a human being there.
Well, that's the thing, you know, like they could send a rover mission to the Kings Valley. That's what I talk about in my book, you know, that they could send one of these rovers, they could just repurpose it to go to the Kings Valley and look at these things. And they've got instruments on the rovers even now that could take samples right from the rock of the King's Face itself, you know. And I mean, I think the excitement of the public when they see something like that happening, and that it's a safe thing, that's something that's built in the very, very remote past and there's no threat whatsoever to them, I think they will demand more funding for this. And I think NASA will end up having a colony there on Mars to investigate this, you know.
Well,
so, I think everybody wins from it, you know.
You know, they're starting to take names and applications for volunteers because I guess this is going to be a one-way trip, isn't it?
Well, it could be. It's like the Mars One idea, you know, of sending colonists there. It's ironic because I actually wrote my book, and it was published just before the Mars One mission thing was announced, you know. So that's how old my book is. And it was basically saying the same thing, you know, of trying to create some sort of colony at the Kings Valley, where different kinds of archaeologists and anthropologists and astrobiologists can study this, you know. But I really think that's where it has to go, you know. I mean, at some point, I think scientists just have to realize that it's a mainstream thing. It's not a fringe science topic at all. If this happened, they have to just go there and find out what happened, you know. I mean,
Greg, one of our guests, Sir Charles Schultz III, is an expert in looking for small artifacts and fossils on Mars, and some of the pictures that he has found are truly remarkable. You know, you look at little tiny artifacts, and clearly you could see that, you know, this looks like a petrified rodent or a petrified iguana or something like that. It defies logic, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, I tended not to go into that side of it, you know, like, because I guess I'm the sort of person that follows a way of thinking called falsification. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. It's from a philosopher, Karl Popper.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, I try to prove things by proving the natural explanations are false. So when I look at something like the King's Valley, I'm trying to think, well, could wind have created the crown face, or could rain have created the crown face, or could a meteor have fallen in the right position to create the crown face eye or something like that? And when you start looking at those sort of things methodically, it doesn't take long to come to the point where you realize that's impossible. And one of the pictures I put on the website, you probably see it's like a face of like a man looking to the right. Did you see that?
Yeah. And then, and then on your website, you know, there's some like a spaceman who looks like he's could be sitting. Very strange.
Yeah, well, a lot of those things are incredible too, but it's very hard to falsify the natural explanation. But when high-rise re-imaged the King's Valley, fortunately, just before I was finishing my book, all of these other details started becoming apparent on the King's Valley wall. And that picture of that face looking to the right, I call that the sculptor. And I think that was probably a representation of whoever it was that actually carved the crown face, because he seems to have his arms outstretched. And again, from looking at the point of falsification, I think it's impossible for that to form naturally, because it's on a very smooth cliff face, and the outline of the shape is dug in to the actual rock. And there isn't any way that wind and rain and or snow or whatever could do that, you know.
I guess if somebody were looking down on us and they came across, of course, they came across Mount Rushmore and saw the four heads of presidents, they'd probably say, wow, look at that. They look like us.
Yes. Well, I was actually thinking of that as an example. Like, just imagine in the future where civilization had changed and there were natives living around Mount Rushmore, and some people were saying, well, it's just a natural formation. The wind and the rain created it. And then other people thought it was artificial, that there was this ancient sculptor that did it. How would you go about proving that it was artificial?
That's a big question. How?
Yeah. Well, one of the ways you can look at this is through this technique of falsification, because if it's natural, someone is saying basically that the wind and the rain or snow or whatever, that it did it, you know. And when you start to look at it from that point of view, it's very hard to support the idea that rain could just spontaneously erode things to create Mount Rushmore.
Exactly.
Yes. And it's very hard to imagine that rain, and there was very very rarely any rain in the Martian past anyway, but rain and wind could somehow create the crown face. Because those photos that I have there, did you notice that there's like three faces that look different to each other?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, basically, the technique that I use in this book of falsification is what I'm saying is that a face can form in the clouds. You know, they call that pareidolia, that people can see faces in the clouds and they see faces in a piece of toast and things like that. But they never see the same face over and over.
You know, it's amazing to me, too, is how these structures resemble structures in Egypt.
Yes.
And, of course, Cairo means Mars.
Yes.
So that's...
Well, that's a dilemma, too, you know. But I've sort of found that these artifacts have to be much older than any possible Earth civilization. Other people may disagree, of course, but... there's too much erosion on the site, and there are faults that have appeared. A geologist in SBSR, for example, Peter Ness, has shown that there's faults that go through the crown face that could only have formed over extremely long periods of time, you know. But the face overlays I've done have basically shown that there's three crown faces in a row, and they're almost identically the same face. And the only difference is there's a very slightly different facial expression. And the point I'm making in the book is that that's not possible to occur by chance. You know, it's like one of the ways you would falsify the idea of Mount Rushmore is that what's the chances of all those faces being next to each other and being so similar to each other?
Mm-hmm. That's true. If erosion...
I've overlaid these faces on each other, and they look like new faces because the actual faces are so similar to each other that they just blend in to create this single face, you know.
If,
so that's what they are, if people were curious, you know.
If erosion were taken out of the equation here, how pristine would these artifacts look?
Well, I think they'd look as pristine as Mount Rushmore does now, you know. I mean,
wow.
If you're going back 3 billion years ago, I think that they were probably carved and looked as clean as that then, you know. There's signs of a possible skin over some areas which may have been like concrete. that's worn away. And there's also a picture of a fish. Did you see the fish that I put up there?
I didn't see the fish one.
There's a couple of pictures I put there. And I don't think they went up there, but they're in my book. There's actually a couple of pictures of they look like someone has carved representations of fish into the cliff wall. and it's almost directly across, opposite the crown face, you know.
And how big are these artifacts, if you had to guess?
I think I can't remember the actual size of it. I think they're...
But they're big, right?
Yeah. The sculptor formation would be tens of meters tall, I think, yeah. But I think they were designed really to look at from the Kings Valley itself. I don't think they were really designed to look at from space, but I can't be sure of that, of course.
Well, we know, like, the Nazca Lines in Peru, which Eric von Däniken wrote about in Fingerprints of the Gods, that whatever they were for, they were made to look at from above. Clearly, they were made to look at from above. So this, you may be right. This may be something for them to see, and we just happen to get a glimpse of it.
Yeah. Well, see, you could stand on the opposite cliff face and look down to the Kings Valley. That's the thing. You can look at the 3D image of the Kings Valley from the high-rise orbital camera, and you can see that's actually quite a deep valley. And so someone could actually be standing like on the edge of the Grand Canyon, more or less. It's not nothing like that deep, of course, but they could be looking down at the faces on the other side. You know.
What do your colleagues in Australia say about your work, Greg?
Well, it's just one of those things that I've been interested in for a long time, and I really just try and prove that it's real, you know. But as to what comes after that, it's very difficult to say, you know. A lot of people in astronomy, I don't think they really know how to deal with the subject, you know. And it doesn't fit very neatly into any kind of scientific field, you know. If you're an astrobiologist, you know, I mean, it doesn't really fit very well into what you're looking at. If you're a planetary scientist, you're mainly interested in geology, and it doesn't really come into it, you know. So I think a lot of people just think, well, there must be some other department somewhere that's looking at this, so I don't have to, you know. So that's probably the biggest reaction I get, is people think, well, someone else is looking after this, you know.
Well, whenever we went to the moon, we had our listening posts in Australia. Very helpful, weren't they?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Always remember that. Well, we're going to take a quick break here, Greg, and come back with a final hour to go. We're going to open up the phone lines. Everybody has an opportunity to chat with you, comments and questions. And again, Greg's book is available for free as a download on his website at coasttocoastam.com with the link there, Why We Must Go to Mars.